some breaking news, and it is not unexpected, and it is that Wimbledon is now cancelled due to public health concerns.
Hello, and welcome to the AO Show, the official podcast of the Australian Open. My name's John Hoovenaars, and this is a special edition of the AO Show following the news that Wimbledon has been cancelled due to COVID-19. Today, we'll look at how this decision affects the sport of tennis and its stakeholders, with analysis from every angle. From Tennis Australia CEO Craig Tiley.
It would have pained them and it pains all of us for it to be cancelled.
The players' perspective from Aussie greats Todd Woodbridge and John Fitzgerald.
It's a part of all of our lives.
It'll be a void this year.
And the media perspective from senior content producer Piers Newbury.
There's going to be a gap. It's going to go from 2019 to 2021.
That's all coming up on a special edition of the AO Show. It is indeed a dark day for tennis, with a gloominess not felt in the sport since the war years. Not only will the All England Club not be opening its gates for the championships this year, but the ATP and WTA have also announced the suspension of both tours until July 13, which covers the entirety of the European grass court season. Joining me to discuss the wash-up to these decisions are Tennis Australia CEO Craig Tiley and Chief Communications Officer Darren Pearce. Craig, if I can start with you, how has Tennis Australia reacted to the news of Wimbledon's cancellation?
Well, first off, let me say, you know, there's a great deal of uncertainty out there, and our primary focus has been day in and day out for the health and the well-being of the communities, sport comes secondary to that. But this seemed like a very much an inevitable decision and the right decision. And we really feel for Wimbledon, for the UK, it's the event. It means so much to the UK as well as to the rest of the world. For all of our tennis friends, for the players, it's a very tough time. I know it's a decision they wouldn't have taken lightly, and there would have been a lot of communication and consideration that would have taken place to get to this point.
Darren, a disappointing decision, but one that was unsurprising given the context of the world at the moment.
Yeah, John, I'd agree to that. I'd say, yes, everyone saw it coming, and the Wimbledon and the All England Club handled it immaculately as they would, and it must have been really tough for them to make that call, tough for the players, tough for tennis. Craig, you'd know we've been going to the championships for years. It's such a pivotal event in the calendar. It's just so important. It means a lot to the whole tennis community, doesn't it?
It does. And there's just something about Wimbledon that's special. And I know the people, everyone involved would have been desperately trying not to have this position, but really, this is about a greater good, and considering the health of the community and the situation we're currently all in right now, and tough decisions have to be made in it, and this would have been a tough one, and we'll certainly miss Wimbledon this year, but you know, with everything going well like it, we would expect it to when we get out of this, we'd look forward to 2021 and the championships returning.
Have you had much contact with Richard Lewis and the team over there during these moments in some of these global tennis talks?
We had a call 2 days ago where Wimbledon indicated both Ian Hewitt, the chair, and Richard Lewis, the CEO, indicated that they were going to be in consideration this week and conversation this week with their board and their board of management. And then make a decision towards the end of the week, which was today. And then I sent Richard a note this morning saying, "I'm sorry, I was to hear the news." But I think they've done the right thing. It's a difficult time for everyone. And these are unprecedented times. And I think the uncertainty about it is the part that's really the most difficult.
Yeah, totally the right call. Obviously, And obviously tennis authorities have got so many decisions they're trying to make and trying to be now fluid with the calendar, which is a tough thing in itself. But there was pretty severe constraints for Wimbledon just because it's on grass, weren't there? Like they couldn't just go any time. There's a very set window.
There's a set window. It's weather, it's grass, it's preparation, and it's the iconic nature of the event is, you know, they want to protect the quality and the lead-in and And that was all would have been all part of their decision. And it's not as easy just to be able to move it to another venue or another time of the year. Or you know, the preparation is really critical, and that it is temperature driven as well. So I think there was no choice. But I know in all their statements, they lead with, you know, saying that the health and the safety of the fans and the players is of primary importance and first and foremost. And when you're not in a position where you can have that and guarantee that, then you have to get to this decision.
Yeah, I know this event, and tennis fans certainly know, growing up as a kid in Australia, this is the one you stay up all night and watch. And I never forget the first time walking in that club and seeing it exactly as I saw it on telly. It was what an amazing moment. And is that how all the Australian tennis players feel, Australian fans, this big event? I know we are in the middle of the biggest health crisis the world has seen in certainly in this century, and yet in the light of all that, it still hits home when they cancel Wimbledon.
Absolutely, it means an incredible amount. Many Australian greats of the game have won many Wimbledon titles. It means a lot to them and a lot to our players, and I think that's where we've got. This is where it becomes real again. Another reminder every day we wake up and there's something. And for the tennis community and the wider community that love this championship and love the event, it hits home again. And just a reminder that we are in this an unprecedented crisis, and we need to, you know, follow the directions of the governments and the advice of, you know, self-isolating and staying at home and everyone to play their part in reducing this infection spread. And Wimbledon are doing no different. They're playing their part as much as it would have pained them and it pains all of us for it to be cancelled. It's the right thing to do.
Well, our hearts certainly go out to everyone affected by this cancellation, and we hope to have tennis back on our screens and our courts soon. Craig, Darren, thanks for your time on the AO Show.
Thanks, John.
Now let's hear the reaction from two of Australia's tennis greats. First of all, 9-time Wimbledon men's doubles champion Todd Woodbridge and also newly inducted Tennis Hall of Famer John Fitzgerald. Welcome, gentlemen. I'll start with you, Todd. What was your immediate reaction to hearing the news that Wimbledon had been cancelled for 2020?
Well, I think even though we knew it was going to happen, it was devastation, I think, is the word. It's that grim reality of what keeps happening to our daily lives and how much it is changing. And for me, it's been such a lifelong thing to do. I first went to Wimbledon when I just turned 16 years of age, and I haven't missed ever since. So the fact that I won't be in London for, you know, 3 weeks in June, July, is going to really hurt, because it's something that's just been quite simply a part of my life for as long as I really can remember now.
And for you, Fitzy, how did it affect you when you heard the news that Wimbledon's been a fairly happy stomping ground for you back in your playing career? I think you made the fourth round a few times.
Oh, my favourite place on earth, I think, Jonathan. Look, like Todd, I've been there more than 35 times for the championships, and so it'll be a void this year. I think it was inevitable. It seems that way. Looking in from our lounge rooms all around the world, I think we all probably saw this coming, but the reality is much stronger than that feeling. So, look, sad, very sad. I think it has to be the right decision for now. I don't think there was any alternative, obviously. But, yeah, a place that I called almost my second home for so many years. I loved going to England in the middle of the summer over there. You know, we'd been in non-English-speaking places to play so often leading up to Wimbledon. And then to get there, it was like almost going home. And the championships is a special, unique place for any tennis lover. No doubt about that.
What is it about Wimbledon and the All England Club that is so illustrious, so special, and so personal to so many players and fans in the tennis world?
I'll start on that because I clearly remember going there for the very first time, and as a junior, but I got to play qualifying, and in those days, as it still is, the qualifying's at Roehampton, and I was in mixed doubles. The first time I qualified for a main draw event at 16 was in the mixed doubles, and it meant that you got sort of that golden ticket to get a player's pass and credential that you could walk through those gates and you're legitimately walking onto the grounds of the All England Club as a player. And for me, that was one of the pure joys of my career, that first time you could say, well, I played at Wimbledon. And it's simple. It's as simple as that, as I've played at Wimbledon. And for any tennis player, that is a dream come true.
And I think from my point of view, you know, the first time I qualified, I was 18 years of age in singles. And it was an irony for me to play my future coach in Sid Ball, a former Australian Davis Cup player who's one of two only father sons that have played Davis Cup for Australia, the Stollies and the Balls. And Sid became a lifelong friend of mine, still is. And I played him in the last round at Roehampton. The courts weren't so flash over there, but gee, when you walked into the All England Club after qualifying and you moved onto the main courts, the standout for me was just the quality of the courts. They were like billiard tables. They were perfect. And I think, you know, like Todd, it was a lifelong dream, even though my life had only been going 18 years at that stage. But you know, from the bush in South Australia and then through boarding school and then starting to travel the world, Wimbledon was the ultimate goal. And I think that was the time in my life, in my career, that the light bulb went off and I actually realised that I might be good enough to earn a living from this sport. Before I qualified for Wimbledon, I was certainly not convinced I was good enough to do that. But for me, it opened the door the first time, and I lost first round in 1979, it was. I remember vividly to Colin Dowdeswell, who was a very good player from Zimbabwe at the time. But it was a stepping stone for me into the future of my career, certainly that first time qualifying at Wimbledon.
If I could talk about my first time qualifying for the singles, it was my second year there at 17. I got through at Roehampton and I walked off the court. And I remember talking to the Australian journalists that were there at that time and said, well, I don't care, you know, who I draw, even if I play the defending champion, that would be special. And of course, lo and behold, that's who I drew. And I got to walk out and open the championships that year. So those traditions that Wimbledon have, you knew if you drew the defending champion, when your match is going to be, first Monday, first centre court match. And that for me was something that I'll never forget. I got hammered, by the way. Cassie just obliterated me. But the one thing that stood out from that moment that I walked onto the centre court, when you come through the doors, you turn left, you step out onto the grass and you hear this electricity. It's like high-powered lines of electricity lines, and you can hear the crackle and the crowd and the intensity, and they just roars as you step onto the court. And there was one thing, after being thrashed by Cashy, I wasn't embarrassed by it. I couldn't wait for that opportunity to get back out onto the centre court again. And, you know, lucky for me, I got plenty more of those opportunities.
Yeah, well, that's losing to a player who at the time was certainly in the top couple of players in the world, wasn't it, Pat Cash? And there's some parallels between Todd and I. I remember the same year that I qualified for singles, I qualified for doubles in 1979, my first experience at the All England Club. And I with a fellow South Australian and a friend of mine, Wayne Pascoe, and I qualified. And we were looking at the draw sheet. Now, and in that year, there were some pullouts in the draw, and in the doubles we had, I can't remember who we'd drawn first round, but they redid the whole draw. So we had to start again, and we start when the draw came out, it was not obviously by email in those days, and it was up on a draw sheet pinned against the wall, and people were crowding around trying to see who they played. And we started at the bottom of the list and where the second seeds were, and we went right to the top, and there were 64 teams in the draw. We got to the top and we were second below the number one seeds, who happened to be John McEnroe and Peter Fleming. And I'll never forget Wayne turning to me and looking at me, and in all seriousness, he said, "It's going to be tough." So that was a pretty daunting thought to go out against McEnroe and Fleming. It wasn't on centre court. It was on an old court set, the old court seven, which is called a different court these days. But we won the first set. And then we got to five all in the second, and John McEnroe turned things on its head within a matter of games. He lit up and just blew us away in those couple of games. But what an experience that was to play one of the great grass courters of all time in your first year at the All England Club.
Well, Todd and Fitzy, the announcement fell on April Fool's Day, but there was nothing funny about it at all. And already we're seeing the cascade of emotions coming from the players on Twitter, and of course led by Roger Federer, who has put out a tweet saying, "Devastated. There is no words that describe what I'm feeling at the moment." And it's really hit the players quite hard.
It will, because it's a routine. It's a part of all of our lives. It's been a constant for most of us since we can remember, when we all wanted to become a touring professional, if you like. And I know from a perspective, if I think of Wimbledon, it's so different from all the other tournaments, because you would leave the continent, the main continent of Europe, and come across to London, and you would get a house, an apartment, a flat or something in and around Wimbledon or Queen's Club. And Wimbledon was like there as a Airbnb before anything like that existed. So what was unique about that is that you could actually set down roots where you could have an apartment with a lounge room, a kitchen, maybe a dining room, and you could feel like you were staying in a house. And that's rare when you're on the road, because you'd come from pretty dingy small hotel rooms throughout the clay court season, and you'd then actually feel like you had, for us, particularly being Australian, it was like home. You got to be able to cook what you'd call your Australian type of food, your meat and veg, and it was so much like home for us, and it was always a great relief to actually get to London. So I think when, you know, you look at Rogers, and he's the same, you know, he would rent the same house as many players do. So and then, of course, you know, you've got to think about his record, and Fitzy, I know it's going to be hard for him probably to be able to come back and win another one, you'd think.
Look, I would think so, Todd. It's you know, logic says that, but he's an extraordinary player who's doing things that we've never seen before. And I thought before he won his 18th Grand Slam at the Australian Open, I had my serious doubts, like most people, I think. I think they'd all admit that in retrospect, that they wondered whether he'd ever win another one then. So can he win another Wimbledon? Well, he made the semis, didn't he, recently at the Australian Open. And so he's still knocking on the door. He's still the best of the rest right now. And at Wimbledon, it's the conditions that suit him. So you need a little bit of luck to move through that draw. I think Wimbledon particularly, if you get a little bit of luck, a little bit of opening in the draw, the skill set to win at Wimbledon can be a little different than the other three Grand Slams. And so he's still a viable competitor, or he would have been this year. Whether he still will be in 2021, that's the question.
And Fitzy, on the women's tour, you've got Serena Williams, who's still gunning to tie that record with Margaret Court for 24.
Well, yes, and this will be a big blow to Serena too. I mean, this whole calendar year, you know, these great players, and we use that terminology too much, I think, in all sports, but the truly two great players that we've just talked about in Roger Federer and Serena Williams, you know, for them, this can change the course of their final list of major victories. It can. It may not, but certainly in Serena's case, she has struggled in recent times to win on that final day at a Grand Slam. So if in fact there are, you know, three Grand Slams that are going to be cancelled this year, if that happens, we don't know yet, we can't get ahead of ourselves, but Wimbledon certainly is gone. And if she doesn't get the opportunity in the next few months to play another couple of Grand Slams, then her chance of catching Margaret Court in terms of pure numbers, it may disappear into the ether. We don't know. It remains to be seen. Can her body hold up at her? And it's, I'm not being disrespectful here, it's an aging athletic body, one of the great players we've ever seen, and has the record in the modern era to certainly make claims of being the greatest player ever. Will she be able to catch Margaret Court's record in numbers? That's a question for her. And she'll be suffering a little bit, I would think, along with Roger Federer in terms of thinking about her final record.
Yeah, I was going to say, John, I think it's important to we've talked about the legends and the champions and their records, but when you hear an event as historical as Wimbledon is cancelled for this year, I think a lot of the rest of the playing group as well, because is a huge effect on them. And it makes you realize how fickle being an athlete can be, because we rely on wins and losses. And that comes down to what you can control as the athlete. But in terms of the ability to, you know, make a living and everything like everybody else has to do, you remember that tennis players are free traders, if you like. They're out there on their own trying to make ends meet, and like most families. And so it's really a difficult time for all of them. And in an interview I did earlier today, I got asked, what message would you give to those players? And you've got to remain positive, and you've got to say to them, well, use this time as best as you can to improve your game. And there'll be different athletes in different parts of their careers. I know, looking back, I wish I'd had a period of time I could have really worked hard on my strength. But when you played so many tournaments through a year, you never got that time to build that up. So if there's an opportunity when gyms can get back open, that athletes can get in and really highlight those things. There's times now you could get on a brick wall and work on those skills, whether it be for your racket work and your volleying and reflexes, and really try to find something out of this that you can come back to the game once we get started again and have really improved. And I think we'll see a lot of athletes come the other side of this with very different mental approaches than what they had leading into the start of this virus. And hopefully many of them will really realize how much they love the game, how much it's meant to them, and take on a real different perspective.
Some good advice. Thank you for sharing, Todd. And thank you, Fitzy, for your insights. We appreciate you joining us here on the AO Show.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Well, the Wimbledon cancellation has sent the world's media into overdrive. We're now going to discuss the fallout from a media perspective, and we're joined by former BBC journalist and now Tennis Australia senior content producer Piers Newbury. And we welcome back Darren Pearce to the discussion. Piers, how big is this story among those that you've covered in your time?
It's a huge story, absolutely massive. Something we just couldn't have imagined a few weeks ago. Having said that, the specific Wimbledon decision has been quite well trailed in the last few days. So right now, it's not so much surprise as resignation and telling the stories and the reaction from the players all around the world. Roger Federer being devastated, Serena Williams coming out and saying how she's shook, she's shaken up. And all the other players will follow over the coming days and hours. And then from a media point of view, it's kind of where next and what happens next. But in isolation, purely cancelling Wimbledon for the first time since the war, since the 1940s, is just a remarkable decision. And the place it sits in the landscape of the sporting summer in the UK, right in the middle, it's the cornerstone, is there every year. You get Ashes tours every few years. You get big football championships every couple of years, Olympics every 4 years. But Wimbledon is there every year. Same time, it's shifted by a couple of weeks the last few years, and that felt like a big decision at the time. It's nothing compared to this. Wimbledon really is there, free-to-air TV, central part of everybody's lives. You can't miss it, and it's part of the national conversation. And so it reaches beyond that tennis audience, and it really will be one of those key things that people are used to seeing and will make everyone realise just how much life has changed.
I'd agree with that, Piers. I think actually your old employer, even running that Aussie Eddie Jones and his speculation over signing on again for England for rugby, gets dwarfed by this. How do you think people like Ash Barty and Novak Djokovic are feeling today?
I think it must be very different for every player. They've all got their own personal experiences, and they've all got their own personal places and where they are on the tour. Fitzy and Todd spoke earlier about Roger and Serena and where they are in their careers. But for Ash and Novak, number one players in the world, prime of their careers, you could say, this is a huge blow. It's a huge blow for everybody throughout the tour. But for them, right at the peak, and Wimbledon is a tournament that Novak's won many times, and it looks beautifully set up for Ash to have a really good run at it. It's a huge blow, and this will mark people's careers. Again, as the guys were saying earlier, when you start missing out Wimbledon, and there'll be a gap on that championship board, the famous board where the players walk on, and gold leaf writing, their names are added straight after their victories, there's going to be a gap. It's going to go from 2019 to 2021. And those two players in particular are ones who would have thought they've got a great chance of putting their name on the board against this year. So huge blow for them right throughout the tree of players, in fact, whether you're a qualifier. I was looking earlier. I mean, if you're qualifying at Wimbledon, you can win £7,000 just for being in the first round of qualifying. If you're a first round loser, I think it's £45,000, £50,000. Players build their years around trying to get into and make progress at the Grand Slams. So from that very practical level, it's a massive blow. And then, yeah, those guys you mentioned right at the top, probably not such an issue for them, but adding to their titles, Wimbledon's got to be one of the targets every year.
Yeah, I see. And I see that you mentioned the British press, and they're obviously among the best in the world in tennis reporting. And so it's not so much of a shock to us because they have been flagging this for a while. But the other news overnight is that the tour still won't commence, not before the 13th of July. And for all those players you're talking about, the real considerations, like a lot of workers around the world, is how they earn their next dollar and feed their families and all that sort of thing. And the media attention, does that turn to that now?
I think it does. I think, obviously, this whole conversation has that caveat that in the grand scheme of things, a tennis tournament is insignificant. People are going through much tougher situations every day. It's a very grave situation all around the world. But having said that, tennis is more than just Novak Djokovic and Ash Barty trying to win the title. They're huge events. They have huge staff. I don't have to tell you guys that. Been running the Australian Open for many years so successfully, from catering, from officials, from production staff. It's people's livelihoods. And when the tours and the sport can get back up and running is more than just a fun diversion for the fans, it's a really serious issue for those people. And same goes for the guys in the media. So if you're a written journalist, there are stories out there to be written still, and there are players to talk to, and the good journos will find them and will be worth following. But if you're, say, in broadcast and you really rely on the tennis actually happening, so you're a commentator or you're a camera guy, that's more difficult. And I know you are, and I'm in touch with lots of these people at the moment, checking in on people and seeing how they're getting on. It's a day-by-day, week-by-week process at the moment, and everyone's waiting for that clarity. So I think that's where those top journalists will really earn their corn, is trying to find out exactly when we can get back to normal, and that's what everybody wants to know, inside tennis or outside of it.
Yeah, it's a challenge finding out the information and the uncertainty that surrounds all of this. And day-to-day media, those broadcasters and ESPN, Eurosport, even Channel 9 Australia, what they put on their screens without not just this but all the sports. You've got the same dilemma, I suppose, haven't you, in filling our channels and across social media? And what are people they're obviously talking about Wimbledon and the tour today, and what else are they looking at?
Yeah, it's been fascinating. It's been one of the, if there is a lighter side to any of this, it's been fascinating to see how media has changed, and this has been a really good eye on that. Firstly, how the players are so good now and driving content and interest so much themselves. If you look at the people who are really good on social media, whether it's a Stan Wawrinka, who's been hilarious and fantastic, Serena's great whenever she's on. There's players from the very best to much less well-known players, but who are fantastic out there and putting content out that people are really enjoying. That's the first place people go. If you're a big broadcaster, a bit more difficult. Everybody's looking into their archives, and we have lots of archive content that we'll be putting out and sharing that with as many people as possible. And it's an opportunity to resurface all of that. And then people get more imaginative, the rise of esports and locking into all of that, how creative you can get around the use of video and graphics. It's a real test for people. who work in those industries of how they fill that time. And some are seeing it as an opportunity and doing a great job. Others will find it difficult. And we'll see, obviously, how long this goes on, the more difficult it will be.
So maybe to cheer ourselves up, let's think about the fondest Wimbledon memory we each have, and let me lead off. And how can I go past Leighton Hewitt's win in the singles? I can't go past that. That's in an era when I was watching every minute of tennis, and it was just amazing to believe. And it even brought back the memories of Kashi in 87 and Yvonne in 1980 and even Nuke back in the 70s. Yes, that's how old I am, so I've wound in a bunch of memories in there. What's the fondest memory you have, if you can single it out, or then maybe there's several?
Well, funny enough, the Leighton's victory in 2002 was my first Wimbledon for the BBC, so that's quite a special one for me, because sitting on BBC court, centre court, working for BBC, is an incredible achievement, incredible privilege, so that one's always pretty special. But the big one for me, because I was 12 at the time, was Boris Becker in 1985, because I was the perfect age to be captured, my imagination captured by a teenager just coming from absolutely nowhere and playing this incredible brand of tennis to win. So that was very special to me. And then I'm afraid I'm going to put my British hat on and just say Andy Murray in 2013. There's been nothing like it in my career. And it really was an event that went beyond tennis in the UK, because to have a British man win Wimbledon, we'd had Virginia Wade in 1977, but we hadn't had a British man since the 1930s, it felt like something that could never happen. And so when it did, and to be there for it, was just hard to believe. And I knew it couldn't get better than that. So after that, I thought it was time to head to Australia.
And we're very glad you did.
Some great memories shared by both of you lads, and hopefully many more to come when the 134th staging of the championships takes place from 28th June to 11th July 2021. Thank you very much for both joining us on the AO Show today.
Pleasure.
Well, that's all for today's special edition of the AO Show. Make sure you subscribe to keep up to date with the latest happenings in the world of tennis. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review so more tennis fans can enjoy the AO Show.